Hey there, welcome to the Faces of Marketing podcast, where we talk about the human stories and lives of different people and perspectives in the marketing profession, and entrepreneurs and movement makers. This is your host, Ryan Buchanan, and I'm here with my good friend, Ray King, founder of Top Level Design and Pork Bun. Ray is a longtime entrepreneur and has founded three other tech ventures, Semaphore, then Snap Names, then About Us. And now you're having a blast with Pork Bun and TLD. Can't wait to dig into all these things and dive in. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Thanks, Ryan. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Awesome. So you and I met like 15 years ago, I think, through Oregon Entrepreneurs Network. And I think that was, yeah, you were at Snap Name, or you had started Snap Names at the time, and which was a, I think I'm getting this right, a way to kind of like buy or barter or reserve or kind of buy a domain name that maybe had already been owned or purchased by that owner.
We called it a back order.
Okay. So that's way better. You just captured like a whole paragraph in two words, back order. Got it.
Yeah. So basically there was, a time where everyone was snapping up .com names. In fact, that time continues to now. There's about 130 million names registered or something like that. So it's really hard to get the name you want. Mm-hmm. And many, many names are registered but not being used. Mm-hmm. And you hear over and over, oh man, I wish I could have this name. I wish I could have that name. It's perfect for my business. I can't get in touch with the owner. They don't want to sell it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get in touch with the owner because then they'll want more money for it, you know, that kind of thing. So we realized that every day a lot of domains drop out of the system. So they expire, and then sometime after they expire, they become available for re-registration. Mm-hmm. And so by asking people, okay, what names do you want? We created this database of desire. So figuring out all the names people wanted, and then basically comparing that every day to the names that drop out of the system. And if there's matches, then we would snap them up.
That's awesome. Snap names. Yeah. I don't think I've told you this story, but, Eroy is a tough domain to get. I mean, at the time,
four letters.
And, short for electronic return on investment. But when I started the company, we had the domain eroydelivers.com because it was taken. And over the course of about a year and a half, we communicated with a one-person company in Australia that was about electronic recording equipment, like tape recorders, and called TPR Systems. So because it was... I just think the strategy of getting domain names is fascinating because we ended up getting the URL of their name, tprsystems.com, started getting leads for them and said, hey, we'd love to trade you domain names. Are you cool with that? And it actually worked. Yeah.
That is a great story. So I've been in the domain industry for so long and I've never heard anyone do that. That is fantastic.
My creative director at the time, he is brilliant, and so I got to give Aaron some credit for that. But it worked. It was awesome. So anyway, I think before we got on the air, we were talking, and you'll be our 30th podcast episode, and you're the first, you know, legit serial entrepreneur of four companies, and I just, you know, I self-identify as an entrepreneur, scrappy entrepreneur, all of that. And you know, we had lunch a couple, I guess about a month ago, and I know you do. And I get asked this question sometimes too, but like, what makes you so passionate to start another company and another company? And now it seems like you're really loving what you're doing now. And you're kind of, unlike some of the other ones, you didn't go the venture capital route. And so, like, what makes you so passionate about being an entrepreneur again and again?
I think it's the joy of building. So building a company is a great joy. You have something which you can be proud of. And I think when I talk to other entrepreneurs and maybe they're, you know, whatever stage they're at, at some point they started with either an idea or a belief, and they just had that that feeling like, I can make this a reality. And I think that journey is really, really fun and really interesting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I love being an entrepreneur, and I love being around entrepreneurs for that reason.
You also seem to have, at least for me, I would say it fuels creativity. And I know you're fashionable, you're into art, you have, I mean, one of the TLDs that you have now is dot design, right? And so, yeah, you're wearing the shirt right now.
I just got advertised.
So I wonder, is creativity part of it as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's, entrepreneurs have to be creative because you're trying to do something that hasn't been done, which means that every day you've got a bunch of obstacles/opportunities. And if you can't think creatively about how to solve them, then you're not going to be able to, navigate your way.
Yeah. Cool. So, when we had lunch a month ago, I am so intrigued by part of our conversation, which, for me and a lot of, my entrepreneurial peers in the Portland area, we've kind of looked up to you for a long time. You Semaphore, that was before I knew you, but you had an exit to Deltek, and that is, mm-hmm. Deltek has gone on to do great things. And then Snap Names, highly respected. And then I forgot who acquired Snap Names.
Oversea.
What is it?
In California. Oversea.
Okay, Oversea, yeah. In California. So successful exit. So investors and employees, very happy with those two experiences. Then About Us was third, right?
Correct.
And, you had a good run at that. You got investment there. And what you mentioned to me at lunch was, and then now you're on your fourth one and it's going really well. But this whole notion that I would not characterize from the outside that About Us was any kind of failure, but I think you have kind of internalized it a little bit, and I asked, like, hey, why haven't I heard you in the news? Because you used to be in the news quite a bit of all this entrepreneurial successful things, and you've been kind of quiet for 5+ years in the Portland business community. And you're like, well, I think your response was like, I really want to prove myself, to start, more openly talk about it. Cause there's this myth that failure is glorified in the entrepreneurial community, and it's really effing hard. Like, failure is not a great thing that any of us aspire to, and it has a consequence. And when I was kind of like internalizing, well, Ray's basically 3 out of 4 huge home runs, and the fourth one was like a minor setback, but it wasn't. But just expand on that mindset, which I so relate to because I had a near business death experience that I hold on to, and that was 8 years ago.
Yeah. Thank you for calling it a
minor setback.
But I think failure is really the right word, because the business never was able to achieve its goals. Its goals weren't clear, and it was a tough experience. And I think that we had this idea of building a wiki that would describe other websites, mm-hmm. and kind of like, it's a little bit meta, right? Mm-hmm. And I got a chance to work with Ward Cunningham, who is the inventor of the concept of wiki. Mm-hmm. He's here in town, brilliant guy. And so it was kind of a neat idea. Mm-hmm. And it had a very early success, mainly because we did something when people came to the site and said, I want to know about this website, like often they would either type in a website that they know, maybe like Amazon.com or something, mm-hmm. Or oftentimes they would type in their own website, right. Say, what information does this site have about my website? Mm-hmm. If we didn't have information about the website, we would quickly scrape the Whois record, and we would also look at the website itself and look at the About Us page, which is hence the term About Us, because the idea was this was like the About Us pages, but written by customers and users versus the company itself. So we would take that information and we'd put a wiki page up, so it looked like you couldn't get to the site and not find information about a website, because we would spawn the page in a few seconds if we didn't have it. And then oftentimes people would see that page, and if it was their own website, they're like, oh man, the Whois debt record's out of date. It was my old address. So then they get in there and edit it. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, oh, I can make maybe some changes to what they see, because they want it to present properly. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden it went from data that was scraped off somewhere to original content.
That was very newsworthy and like credible.
Yeah. I mean, it was a good concept. And as a result, the site grew very, very quickly. We had tens of millions of pages, and we had a lot of people hitting the site. I mean, I think it was like the most popular site in Oregon for a year or two, something like that.
That's cool.
And at some point we decided to start monetizing the traffic. We put a little AdSense ad up. And AdSense
it's a Google product, right?
Yeah, it's a Google product. It's designed to help content sites monetize their content. So if you've got a site that has a lot of content about a certain topic, you put an AdSense ad up, and it directs people to advertisers, and you start making money. Our site worked particularly well with AdSense, because what AdSense does is it senses the information on the page. So if we've got a page about abcgolf.com or something, and the text on it is about golf, it puts up an ad that's golf related. Mm-hmm. And because it does it all algorithmically, and our site is not about anything in particular, it's about other websites, mm-hmm. It just worked really well. Mm-hmm. So we were generating a ton of traffic, and we had a lot of income coming in very quickly. It was crazy. We put this little ad up, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden we had hundreds of thousands of dollars, per month rolling in. So we had this kind of very interesting start. But the problem we had was that the people were mostly self-editing, and a lot of people didn't edit, which means we had just a lot of pages that were kind of junky, mm-hmm. and the site didn't really have that much actual value. So it generated a ton of traffic, but Google over time penalized us. So every time they had a panda update or all those updates that they did, they would decrement our rating, our SEO rating. Mm-hmm. And so things started just slowly moving in the wrong direction. And we were kind of addicted to the revenue and the model.
And the whole model was built on Google, right? So revenue came from Google, yes. AdSense. And yes. when Google changed their algorithm, you were screwed by Google.
Correct.
You know? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. So we started getting less revenue. And as a result, we kept looking for things to shift the business and create more actual content value. But it was hard because the site was so big and had so much traffic. It was just very hard to pivot. We probably did four or five different ideas. We started making lists of websites. We started writing articles for people and charging for that. We did a number of different things, none of which really worked that well. Mm-hmm. And I think over time, it's tough. Every time when you pivot, some people fall off. They were like, they thought the idea was great. They think the idea is not so good. But the first couple times you pivot, people will, you're the leader. Let's go in this direction. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have that many pivots. Mm-hmm. And I think when you make one or two pivots too many, People lose confidence, and I lost the confidence of my staff, my developers, and I couldn't really recover from that. I felt like I got to a place where I felt like I just couldn't lead the company anymore. And that's when we ended up getting merged in with Atenza here in town. So some of the assets and people are still there. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was, definitely a personal failure.
So for me, and I'll redirect this back to you, it was the failure of a lot. Like, I had 38 out of 41 employees leave over a 6-month period when I did, it was one big pivot, but, kind of three rounds of, cash getting really tight. And so having to ultimately say the software, we're going to try and transform from a creative agency to a software company, that ultimately failed, and we had to go back to being a creative agency. But the fact that I didn't have the hard conversation up front and was selling this software company vision and wasn't really honest with employees of like how risky it was, and that the consequence could very likely be them losing their job because of just running out of cash. That was the hardest thing for me years later to realize that I was the problem, B, just the human factor of feeling like I went from hero to villain. Like, it was just so black and white. So I just wonder, was it your staff, or I didn't really have, I had family and friends, investors, and a bank loan that I had to pay back very quickly, but it was the staff that, like, I hung on to that failure the longest.
Yeah.
What about you?
I feel like, with About Us, we raised about $5 million, and that was from a number of angel investors, and as well, one VC. So I have that same pain, because you have gone out there and you've said what a great idea this is. You've asked people to put their money in. Mm-hmm. On the employee side, you've asked people to leave good jobs. Yeah. You've asked them to give you really a lot of effort, a lot of time, at startup wages, and so there's a lot on the line. Mm-hmm. And when your business starts not doing well, it's a ton of pressure. Mm-hmm. So I would say that I feel pretty bad about for the investors as well. Mm-hmm. I know some of the angel investors have a lot of money. They didn't put that much in, and it's like, okay, but there's some that, for whom it was a real investment. Mm-hmm. And I know it affected them, and, I see them. Some of them are still good friends of mine, and I still feel like apologizing. Hey, I'm sorry. I really feel bad that didn't go the way we expected. And they're so good about it, which just makes me feel worse.
I hear that. Tough. Yeah, it's no, so I hear that. But, well, thanks for sharing all that. All right, so I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I think for almost anyone listening to this podcast is unlike you in that we do not know the domain world that well at all. But we consume it. Like, we use the internet all the time. It's so in our lives. And yet I am so fascinated by how it works. Like, when you type in a URL or you go to any website, explain how this governing body called ICANN works. Companies, people spend millions of dollars to get a domain, like the end of it, like dot agency or dot design or whatever.
Right.
There's lots of, what was the highest
dot web?
Dot web was like 100 something million.
150 135 million maybe. Yeah, I think it was 135.
Right, yeah. There. But how, like, when you type in a website, how does that work of a .com or .web or?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think it's, if we just roll back, you know, the internet basically started with internet protocol, which is a way in which computers could communicate with each other. And when that first came into existence, each node or server was assigned an IP address, an internet protocol address, and that's how you knew. It's like a phone number. Like if I call your phone, then I use your phone number to get there. And in, I think around 1985 or so, someone had the idea to say, why can't we put a more human recognizable and rememberable name in place to represent an IP address?
Because that IP address is like 192.10, yeah, all numbers. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. It's four numbers. I mean, I think everyone's seen them, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like number dot number dot number dot number, and very difficult to remember. So it's a lot easier to remember Amazon.com.
Right.
Right. So when they put that system in place, they said, well, there probably should be some delineation for what type of domain it is. And they said each country should have a code. And so, for example, now France has .fr, and Korea has .kr, and Germany has .de. And we in the U.S. actually have .us as well, which is strangely lesser known since we're very married to .com. But that was the idea. And then someone else, I think, who was in the discussion said, oh, there should be some generic ones, like COM for commercial or companies, NET for network infrastructure, org for organizations. And then eventually there was also like MIL, military, EDU, GOV. And that was like in the original set. And I think at the time, the thinking was, oh, no one will use COM. But they ended up putting, okay, whatever, we'll put it in anyway. And of course, you know, it turned out to be wildly popular. But when they put that system in place, that was the DNS system, domain name system, and this map between IP addresses and domain names obviously greatly helped people navigate the internet. And the organization that now oversees the policy around the domain name system is ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. So assigned names and numbers is that piece that connects the names and numbers. And for a long time, we had just those extensions. You said the part to the right of the dot, like the .com, .net, .org.
Right.
Some people call them extensions.
Okay.
They're also called TLDs, which is a top-level domain. So the thing furthest to the right is a top level. The thing to the left of the dot is a second level. So if you look at Amazon.com, the word Amazon is second level, or the SLD, and .com is a top level TLD. So for many years, people have said, well, why can't there be more extensions? And it just took a very long time. ICANN does not move very quickly. And so they allowed a few here, a few there. You may have seen like .info. .biz, .tel, and there's some more that most people haven't heard of. But there was they dripped them out a little bit here, a little bit there. And in 2012, they opened it a little bit wider, and they made a more consistent application process. So the application was still tough, but if you said, I want to run a domain extension, then you can say, you can fill out this application, and you have to demonstrate that you have the technical expertise, you understand ICANN and the policy around domains, you understand intellectual property, you've got financial wherewithal to maintain this piece of the internet fabric. And if you go through that process, then you can run the TLD. You can become the registry operator for that TLD.
Yeah, I think like the common perception is that massive corporations like control all of that. It just seems like, you know, we don't even know, they're faceless or whatever, but maybe it's Google and Apple and all the, and Facebook, like these big, but like for just for simplifying, like a little guy in Portland, Oregon, like somehow like applies and all of a sudden controls these, you know, these important TLDs, and then can sell them to millions of people and companies. It's like, that is so crazy how democratizing that is at this global level. It's kind of cool. It's kind of like Tony Stark, but for the common man. but it's also really expensive. Like, you have to get investors, or maybe if you have enough money, like, it's not a cheap thing to get into.
That's true. There are some large companies in the space. So Google has a bunch of extensions. Amazon has a bunch. The largest player in the space is a company called Donuts, up in Seattle. And
Donuts and pork bun. Okay.
Yeah, sweet and savory. they apply for a whole bunch. So the way it works is that anyone can apply. Literally anyone can apply, as long as you are able to get through the application process. It was $185,000. You send that check in with your application, basically, and that pays for ICANN to go through vetting your application, and all the work that goes around figuring out if you should have it, or if also, and if more than one person applies, then what to do in that case.
So it's like going to college, basically. I'm going to apply to college. It's only 185 grand. Yeah.
So actually, originally, we were only going to apply for one. And because the process looked kind of daunting, and we were, you know, somewhat late to the process as well. But we wanted .wiki because About Us was all about wikis, and I love wikis, and you know, probably that's a separate conversation, but I think wikis are great tools for online collaboration and for people to join together around areas of interest. So we went through that whole process, and then afterwards, you look at it and say, it wouldn't be that hard to apply for another because many of the questions are the same. And using that thinking, we ended up applying for 10. So we applied for .wiki, .art, .design, .style, .photography, .group, .gay, .llc, .blog. Did I say art?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll get the other one later.
Style.
Oh.
I don't know. I'm missing one. Anyway, so we applied for 10 in total, and we ended up getting 4. So we ended up getting .design, .wiki, .inc, and most recently .gay.
That's super cool. We're going to pause.
Okay.
Because I want to kind of get into the human story of Ray, and then we're going to come back to the strategy behind launching a kind of consumer brand called Pork Bun that seems like a restaurant, but it's totally not. And get into the kind of that whole strategy. But okay, we're going to pause on that and go to our normally programmed schedule of like how you grew up in New York City.
I did.
And, you know, like what, so you're kind of a city boy.
Yeah.
And what are your folks like? Do you have siblings? Like, what was it like when you're, you know, 6, 8, 10 years old, growing up in the Bronx or New York City?
Yeah, I grew up in New York, Manhattan.
Actually. Oh, Manhattan. Okay.
And yeah, to me, a lot of people ask the question: is it weird to grow up in Manhattan, a big city, something like that? And it wasn't weird for me because it's all I knew. And I think I had a pretty normal upbringing.
Where, what neighborhood in Manhattan?
I grew up on the Upper East Side.
Okay.
So I think we were on 91st in Madison. And then a little bit later, we moved to around 72nd and 3rd, which is still Upper East Side, just a little bit further down. And I went to public school, PS6 to be specific, and public junior high school, and same for high school.
But I saw on LinkedIn or Facebook that you went to like Bronx, was it a charter school that was science focused or?
Yeah, there was at the time 4 specialized schools in the New York area. There was Brooklyn Tech, Bronx Science, Stuyvesant, and Hunter. And those were all high schools you had to test into. So my sister had gone to Bronx Science. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of followed her. She was a couple years ahead of me. And I went there. It's a great school. A little bit of a trek for me, so I had to, you know, take the train all the way up into the Bronx, but a great school nonetheless.
So have you always, since a little kid, have you always been into, you know, coding and tech and science stuff? Or did you just like, oh, I look up to my sister. I'm just going to do what she did. Like, how did that come about?
I think I was kind of science and techie, so I was definitely more in the math and science than on the humanities and liberal arts side of the equation. Mm-hmm. And so Bronx Science was, you know, it was kind of natural for me. I think I did well there mainly because I was able to, I really liked math at the time and like puzzles and things like that. So I was, you know, on the math team and, you know, had a really bunch of really nerdy friends.
I was going to ask about that. Like, do you guys compare pocket protectors and, you know, like get the whiteboard out and try and be all, what was that? The Matt Damon character in Good Will Hunting, you know?
Right. Yeah. no, I wasn't quite at his level, but yeah, we were definitely the nerdy bunch, and they were hard to keep up with because back in the day, that stereotype of the Asian kid that parents are probably like, you have to get all A's, and that was very much the case, and I think that they probably had more hardcore parents than I did. So,
like the tiger mom stereotype of just...
Yeah, I think that was definitely the case because these guys were all like, you know, 99 or 100 on every single test, every single thing, valedictorian, salutatorian, like, all that stuff. And, you know, I had to like to struggle to try and keep up.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a white guy, it's just probably not my place to like go into Asian stereotypes, but like musical instrument, was that also part of it?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Definitely. After school, mm-hmm. then it was Chinese class on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. You just packed in whatever you could.
And your folks, did they also grow up in New York, or did your? I know you have family in Beijing or Shanghai.
Shanghai. Yeah, no, my parents are both from Shanghai.
Okay,
and they came over roundabout. Well, my mom actually came directly to the States. And then my dad went to high school in Hong Kong and then some university studies in London and then came to New York. Mm-hmm. You know, but all around the time that there was cultural revolution and all that going on in China. Mm-hmm. And so they've been here for a long time.
And I remember years ago when we had breakfast, you were like, the entrepreneurial community in Shanghai is off the charts. Like, did your parents, is that a newer thing, or are your parents pretty entrepreneurial as well?
My dad's an architect. Okay. And my mom was a ceramicist and also helped my grandfather a lot with his artwork and his collection, as well as his personal art work that he did himself. So they weren't like on the tech scene or anything like that. I think that Shanghai is, China in general, absolutely booming with creative energy and entrepreneurialism for both tech and business, et cetera. But that wasn't really my parents' scene.
I both my parents are entrepreneurs, and so I wonder if they would have been more entrepreneurial if there was a platform for it, you know? I don't know.
Interesting question.
So you're around a bunch of nerdy friends, and it clearly rubbed off on you because you got into MIT, and I was just, you know, having a daughter who's applying to colleges literally this summer, she's heading into her senior year. Why MIT versus like other colleges, you know, Stanford or wherever? Like, what drew you there? Was it just like you realized you maybe had to work harder at it, but you really did love the tech thing and you wanted to be immersed in tech all the time at MIT? Like, why MIT? Yeah.
I don't remember knowing that many other schools, but it was a dream of my dad's from really young. It's just like, that's the best school, you know? Mm. And if there's any way you can go there, you should go there. So I didn't have any other school in my mind. Like, I only applied to MIT. So,
okay.
I mean, probably if I hadn't gotten, I would have.
Did you visit there before you applied there?
I don't think I visited, no. I really had that first
tunnel vision
in my mind,
yeah.
Right? So,
yeah. I've talked to a lot of, like, I always ask this question, and it's usually 50-50 on, everybody has this fascinating story, like, cultural, like, for me, my family is all about, like, visiting tons of schools, like, get, you know, kind of visualizing it, all of that stuff. But other
smart.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really helpful, but I think other people, some people, you know, college wasn't even on the radar and don't think it's that important to, you know, how they became an entrepreneur and stuff like that. So it's just, it's all over the map. But I always, you know, I had in my head, as I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking that you had the science and tech pedigree to like just flow right into MIT and that you would have scoped it out and, you know, all that stuff. But
yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah, actually, I think I did, you know, pretty well grades and SATs and all that stuff, but I probably wasn't a shoo-in. It was mainly like the math team stuff that probably made me look, you know, enabled me to get in there. But when I got there, it was hard. I remember that in high school, you can take different levels of math and stuff. So I had done like the first two like calculus classes or something. And when I got there, it's like, wow, I'm going to be ahead. I have this like one credit, you know? Mm-hmm. And my roommate came in and he had 5 credits. So he had done, he was like 4 years ahead of me in math.
Dang.
And I remember he went to like this little school in Arkansas, and he was so far ahead that he basically got pulled out and specially tutored, and there was a lot of kids like that. So what
kind of like geniuses everywhere.
Yeah,
that is not my experience.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I want to give full credit, but I think a lot of these kids just worked hard also. Yeah. And they were, you know, very studious. A lot of them were valedictorians in their school, and so it was tough. And then also I had this crazy idea that I wanted to graduate early, which is the dumbest thing ever. I don't know why anyone would want to do this, but I tried to be on a schedule to get out in 3 years instead of 4.
Gosh.
So I was totally loaded up on classes in the first year, and they were really hard, so I struggled. Yeah.
Would you say that, like, I find that kind of years 16 years old to 22 or 24 is such a formative time that it really sets you up for, you either have something that really pushes you to your core and it's like something really traumatic happens, or there's like some life moment of independence that happens. And was there, did you have one of those where it was like, what would be that life moment in that time frame where it was like this big thing that you had to overcome, or like this kind of breakout independence that you had? Or
so I didn't graduate. My father had some health issues and we did not have a good financial situation, so it was actually very difficult to continue. And I had this somewhat of a, always the ability to kind of make money on the side doing things. And so I decided to come back to New York and work for a year or two in order to kind of put myself on better financial footing to be able to go back. And I did go back for one semester, and it was too hard to manage this business that I had started at the same time.
That's when you co-founded Semaphore, is when you...
Yeah, actually that was the computer school.
Okay.
Right.
That was I missed that one. Yeah, I didn't know about that one.
It wasn't really a business, but the computer school was, we were helping people understand how to use at first Apple IIs and then IBM PCs. Mm-hmm. So I should probably go back just a little bit. My sister had a babysitting business, and I thought that was really cool because she was earning money. So I kind of pushed into that in high school. And because I was the first kid to have a TI-59, the first kid to have an Apple II computer, the parents of the people, the kids I was babysitting for, always wanted me to show their kids how to use the newer technology. So it kind of went from, we need you to babysit because we're going out, to we'd like you to come. We're here.
Tutor, train.
Right. Want you to tutor our kids. You're great at math, you know, so could you help them with their math homework at the same time? You know, oh, we're going to buy a computer. Just whatever you have, we're going to buy the same thing. And can you show our kids how to use it? So I was doing that. And then I was having kids come over to my house. I cleared my bedroom out. I moved into the living room. I put four computers in the bedroom. And I was just like, hey, if I can train four kids at a time, I can make more money. So instead of making, you know, from babysitting, from $5 an hour babysitting to $60 an hour tutoring to getting four kids in the room was, you know, kind of where I was in high school. And that's why I knew I could make money. And when I couldn't continue with school, I came back and did that for about a year. And
did your dad's health improve? Or
yeah.
Okay.
He did. He's really a survivor. So he did well afterwards, health wise. And I did have a tough experience, which you're just like jogging my memory on this. I ended up partnering with two guys from Price Waterhouse and spent a year kind of building this training business. And when it was time to go back to school, I'm gonna try and be as fair as possible, but I think they just figured maybe I'm going back to school. They didn't really need me. So we had a partnership struggle where I basically said, this is the deal we made, was that I was going to stay here for a year, get this started. And I was still going to be a partner. I was going to go back to school. So we ended up in a lawsuit, believe it or not. And that was actually a little bit of a defining moment too, because I was like, okay, whatever. I'll just move on. But my dad was like, no, you've been wronged and we're going to fight this. And I don't care what it costs. We're going to we're going to get a lawyer. So we literally down the hall, you know, there was a lawyer and we fought this thing. It was, you know, low stakes at the time, but we ended up winning. And it was great to know that my dad was so in my corner.
It's kind of social justice and family justice all together. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, but then after that, I couldn't really continue with the training business, and I was kind of tired of it, and that's when I started Semaphore and tried to go back to school at the same time, which was just not a good formula for success.
Yeah. Awesome. That's cool of you to share that. So, just to fast forward a little bit, because got a sense of Ray, the person in there, of how you grew up and all of that. I wanted to come back. I think maybe talk a little bit of the origin story of Semaphore, and it was kind of software in the architecture and engineering space.
Yeah. Well, my dad was running an architecture business, mm-hmm. and had about 10 employees, and needed a way to track their time and create invoices in a more, he said, well, you've got a computer, maybe we can find a way to make a more automated system to create these time billing invoices. Mm-hmm. So I wrote something to do that. And after doing that, invoices would pile up, they needed to be collected. So I wrote a little system to track cash receipts and create a little small account receivable system around that. Mm-hmm. And then there were expenses that needed to show up on invoices, so we hooked on a cash disbursement system and a payable system. And before we knew it, you had like a mini, all the pieces for an accounting system. So
for really, it then expanded later to like any service-based business like Eroy could use Deltek software. No, or is it, oh, it okay.
Always
that vertical.
Right. So from 1985 all the way to 2000, it was software, financial management software, which was all those accounting pieces. And then we built more related pieces around that. So we had like 13 modules of software is how we sold it back then. And we only focused on architects, engineers, and designers.
Okay.
That entire time.
Huh.
We should have broke out, but we didn't.
So was it cool to be able to talk the same language around architecture with your dad? Like, was there a lot of kind of bonding and mentoring happening both ways? Like, you could share with him how the technology worked, he could share with you how architecture works?
I would say my dad taught me more about just business in general. Like, you know, here's how you rent a space. He helped us renovate, you know, as we grew, because we grew from myself, you know, up to over 100 people. And in that process, we've renovated two or three different offices, which he helped with. But I wasn't that much on the architecture side. And the technology was, you know, he's like, you handled technology, obviously. So I would say that it was nice to be able to work together for a period of time. But, you know, over time, it just became an independent entity.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So I'm going to fast forward to what we were talking about before with this whole TLD and pork bun. Talk to me about pork bun, like what you, I think in order to do that, you might have to explain like how the business, like the, yeah, the financial model of having a domain name like dot ink, dot design, you know,
right.
dot gay, those things, how you make money off of those domains.
Sure.
And then pork bun is kind of a competitor to GoDaddy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I would say that the understanding our industry, requires you to understand that there are registrars and registries, which I know sound very similar, but this is where it, how it works. Registries are in charge of a given top-level domain or a given extension. So there is a registry called VeriSign that's in charge of .com. There's a registry called PIR that's in charge of .org. And we are the registry. Our company name is actually Top Level Design, mm-hmm. which is a little bit of play on words for top-level domain. Mm-hmm. And we are the registry for, again, .wiki, .ink, .design, and .gay. So think of the registry as the wholesale provider. So if you wanted to get a name that ended in one of those extensions, you would go to any registrar. So for example, GoDaddy or Two Cows or Network Solutions or name.com. Mm-hmm. And you would see if the name's available. Mm-hmm. And if it was, then you would pay whatever they ask for, which would include our wholesale fee. So we would get the wholesale fee. So for Dot Design, it's $33. And the registrar, who is the company that interfaces with end users, would put a retail markup on top of that. So GoDaddy is the largest registrar in the world. Registries can only sell through registrars, so they're not publicly facing. And registrars source names from registries. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm thinking this is a really weird analogy, but like the gas station, you know, you, they're Exxon and Mobil and all the, like, there's a few out there that you, they sell gas to, maybe that's not even going to work. But then, you know, there's a markup a little bit at the gas station, and some gas stations could have a huge markup, like potentially Network Solutions, and others like Pork Bun have much less of one because you're trying to ultimately get more people to buy your yeah. top, yeah. your TLD.
I think that's fair. Let's just stick with wholesale and retail.
Yeah, way better.
The easiest way to think about it. I should have just said that to start with.
Yeah.
So our four TLDs are on the wholesale side, and Pork Bun is the retail.
All the retail for all the TLDs, anything you want.
Correct. Actually, yeah. Pork Bun started as just a way to support selling Dot Design.
Okay.
So it started only selling our own TLDs. Mm-hmm. And then over time, we added more TLDs because if a person has a dot design name with us, they mm-hmm. might also have some dot com names, and it's easier to have them housed in one place. So we began to add more extensions, and now we have over 400 or something like that. We also added email and hosting, which are kind of necessary components for people to really use your names. And over the course of a couple of years, it went from a specialty registrar to a more general purpose registrar. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do is give people great value. So we mark up names at most a dollar. Mm-hmm. So if the wholesale price for a name is $20, we mm-hmm. sell it for $21 plus the credit card fee.
And competitors more double it, like $40.
I would say that across most registrars, doubling is probably at the high end. Mm-hmm. A lot of registrars might add 30%, 50%, mm-hmm. something like that. But we're pretty much mm-hmm. at the low end in terms of mm-hmm. in terms of value.
Mm-hmm. So getting to the emotional side of running a company that, you know, didn't take VC money in this round, I feel like you're more relaxed. Is that because, you know, you're a little older, you've been through all this, and the roller coaster, you know, isn't as steep? Or is it just that the company's doing well and it's throwing off cash?
I'm glad
cash?
You think I look relaxed.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. No, I actually, you know, I do have some partners who put money mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. To get some of to do the applications and to bid for Dot Design in particular, because that was heavily contested. We have done well since then. Dot Design has over 100,000 registrations, and you know, with the other two, we're up over 150,000 registrations.
Yeah, how did you market Pork Bun? How did you get? I know some of it's wholesale and some of it's through Pork Bun, but like, because that's the retail. Yeah. Brand, and it seems like, you know,
let me separate
okay.
the two. So on the registry side, Dot Design is just intrinsically a good extension. There are lots of different types of designers. So you have graphic designers, interior designers, furniture designers, jewelry designers, lighting designers, acoustic designers. There's many, many different types of designers, all for whom Dot Design makes sense. And Dot Design also works well at the end. So you would naturally say, you know, Smith and Jones Design. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to say Smith Jones Dot Design. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is why it was heavily contested, because many people understood this, but it's the one that we really held out for and decided we wanted to purchase. In addition to that, we have gone to a ton of trade shows. So we'll go to AIGA, the American Institute of Graphic Artists, or IDSA, the Industrial Design Society of America. They all have trade shows. We've sent a ton of mailers out to different types of designers. We've done videos, we've done podcasts, we've really tried to get the word out there as best as possible. We've also been lucky in that a lot of larger name companies use .design. So you can go, for example, to Facebook.design or Uber.design, Amazon.design, Airbnb.design, and quite a few more, and you will see sites that are aimed at recruiting. You'll see sites that house design assets. You'll see sites that connect with design communities, and also sites that are adjacent to, like Facebook has another site, origami.design, that helps them work with their app designers. So we've had a lot of exposure at that level as well. And I think that's why the registry side of the business is doing well. .gay we haven't launched yet. That we're going to launch in beginning of next year. So that was a little bit more involved in order to get it. So think that that'll be good. So that's the registry side of the business.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on the retail side, which is the registrar, Pork Bun, as I mentioned, we have a low-cost strategy, which is great because it gets people in the door. We also have a design strategy. So we've put a lot of effort into the UX and our goal is to leave people with a great experience when they come to our site. And I think we've achieved that because also we're later to the game. So we've had the advantage of not having a bunch of legacy processes and code to have to worry about. So we've got just a really smooth user interface.
And how the name, like, do you have do you have a restaurateur on your team?
No, it's actually, you know, when you're in this industry long enough, you accumulate names. And when you start new business, you always go to your basket of names and say, well, what name would work? And it was a toss up between Flyware and Pork Bun. And we just thought Pork Bun was cute and fun and the better name.
I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as we're wrapping up here, is there any life moment that you haven't shared with us that or maybe expanding on one that you shared before where it's kind of not a surprise that you are where you are, like something that maybe happened to you along the way in your life, where I always think it's fascinating that, like, I always give this example, like when I was 18, I drove solo across country and worked at Glacier National Park. And, you know, it was just this like massive independence thing that I realized I could do anything after that. And I just wonder, is there a life moment for you that was like, okay, like this was pretty defining and it makes sense that I'm here in Portland, Oregon, and that I'm an entrepreneur doing this. And
That's an interesting question. I think that growing up in Manhattan and being kind of a street kid, it was like, I would say the defining moments, if I could add an S to that, were like getting out on the street and interfacing with the public. So even I was like five, I played my flute on the street and had a hat and collected coins. And then we sold iced tea on the street. And then when I started the computer business, we put a stand, and we had a computer and we just pitched a stand in front of Grand Central Station, used electricity from the newspaper stand that was next to us, which made his light go off. But he loved the fact that we had a card table, put an IBM PC on it. And same idea, just talk to people on the street. Come look at this. We had, at first VisiCalc, but then eventually Multiplan and Lotus, but we showed people how to use spreadsheets. And at the time, in 83, 84, 85,
no one had seen those. Yeah,
no one had seen it. So you would just pop a spreadsheet open and you'd say, hey, I'm going to just put like the numbers 1, 2, and 3 on the screen, and then I'm going to sum them. And so now it equals 6. And people are like, wow, that's really cool. They're like, oh, so it's like an adding machine. I'm like, wait. Now I'm going to change one of those numbers. And when you change a number and the total changes automatically on the screen, people were just dying on the street, like falling down dead. And
you're like a magician.
Exactly, because it was so cool. It was new, and people could just see the possibility. And there were tons of accountants and lawyers all the time coming through Grand Central Station. So I would say the defining moment was just like getting out there and being able to talk to total strangers and get them to share a little bit of your, you know, what excites you.
That's awesome. Well, I love these little insights into our past worlds that help define who we are today. So thanks so much for being on the show, Ray. It's awesome.
Awesome. Thanks, Ryan.
All right. Cheers.